But most of all, since in every one of his actions and thoughts which had reference to Odette, Swann was constantly subdued and swayed by the unconfessed feeling that he was perhaps not less dear, but at least less welcome to her than anyone, even the most wearisome of the Verdurins' faithful, when he betook himself to a world in which he was the paramount example of taste, a man whom no pains were spared to attract, whom people were genuinely sorry not to see, he began once again to believe in the existence of a happier life, almost to feel an appetite for it, as an invalid may feel who has been in bed for months and on a strict diet, when he picks up a newspaper and reads the account of an official banquet or the advertisement of a cruise round Sicily. If he was obliged to make excuses to his fashionable friends for not paying them visits, it was precisely for the visits that he did pay her that he sought to excuse himself to Odette. He still paid them, asking himself at the end of each month whether, seeing that he had perhaps exhausted her patience and had certainly gone rather often to see her, it would be enough if he sent her 4,000 francs, and for each visit he found a pretext, a present that he had to bring her, some information which she required. Monsieur de Charlus, whom he had met actually going to her house, and who had insisted upon Swann's accompanying him. And failing any excuse, he would beg Monsieur de Charlus to go to her at once, and to tell her, as though spontaneously in the course of conversation, that he had just remembered something that he had to say to Swann, and would she please send a message to Swann's house, asking him to come to her then and there. But as a rule, Swann waited at home in vain, and Monsieur de Charlus informed him, later in the evening, that his device had not proved successful. With the result that, if she was now frequently away from Paris, even when she was there he scarcely saw her, that she who, when she was in love with him, used to say, "I am always free," and "What can it matter to me what other people think?" now, whenever he wanted to see her, appealed to the proprieties or pleaded some engagement. When he spoke of going to a charity entertainment, or a private view, or a first night at which she was to be present, she would expostulate that he wished to advertise their relations in public, that he was treating her like a woman off the streets. Things came to such a pitch that in an effort to save himself from being altogether forbidden to meet her anywhere, Swann remembered that she knew and was deeply attached to my great-uncle Adolphe, whose friend he himself also had been, went one day to see him in his little flat in the Rue de Bellechasse, to ask him to use his influence with Odette. And as it happened, she invariably adopted, when she spoke to Swann about my uncle, a poetical tone, saying, "Ah, he is not in the least like you. It is an exquisite thing, a great, a beautiful thing, his friendship for me. He's not the sort of man who would have so little consideration for me as to let himself be seen with me everywhere in public." This was embarrassing for Swann, who did not know quite to what rhetorical pitch he should screw himself up in speaking of Odette to my uncle. He began by alluding to her excellence, a priori, the axiom of her seraphic superhumanity, the revelation of her inexpressible virtues, no conception of which could possibly be formed. "I should like to speak to you about her," he went on. "You, who know what a woman supreme above all women, what an adorable being, what an angel Odette is. But you know also what life is in Paris. Everyone doesn't see Odette in the light in which you and I have been privileged to see her. And so there are people who think that I am behaving rather foolishly. She won't even allow me to meet her out of doors at the theatre. Now, you, in whom she has such enormous confidence, couldn't you say a few words for me to her, just to assure her that she exaggerates the harm which my bowing to her in the street might do her?" My uncle advised Swann not to see Odette for some days, after which she would love him all the more. He advised Odette to let Swann meet her, everywhere and as often as he pleased. A few days later, Odette told Swann that she had just had a rude awakening. She had discovered that my uncle was the same as other men. He had tried to take her by assault. She calmed Swann, who at first was for rushing out to challenge my uncle to a duel, but he refused to shake hands with him when they met again. He regretted this rupture all the more, because he had hoped, if he had met my uncle Adolphe again sometimes, and had contrived to talk things over with him in strict confidence, to be able to get him to throw a light on certain rumours with regard to the life that Odette had led in the old days at Nice. For my uncle Adolphe used to spend the winter there, and Swann thought that it might indeed have been there, perhaps, that he had first known Odette. The few words which someone had let fall in his hearing about a man who, it appeared, had been Odette's lover, had left Swann dumbfounded. But the very things which he would, before knowing them, have regarded as the most terrible to learn and the most impossible to believe, were, once he knew them, incorporated for all time in the general mass of his sorrow. He admitted them, he could no longer have understood their not existing. Only, each one of them in its passage traced an indelible line, altering the picture that he had formed of his mistress. At one time, indeed, he felt that he could understand that this moral lightness, of which he would never have suspected Odette, was perfectly well known, and that at Baden or Nice, when she had gone in the past, to spend several months in one or the other place, she had enjoyed a sort of amorous notoriety. He attempted, in order to question them, to get into touch again with certain men of that stamp, but these were aware that he knew Odette, and besides, he was afraid of putting the thought of her into their heads, of setting them once more upon her track. But he, to whom up till then nothing could have seemed so tedious as was all that pertained to the cosmopolitan life of Baden or of Nice, now that he learnt that Odette had, perhaps, led a gay life once in these pleasure cities, although he could never find out whether it had been solely to satisfy a want of money, which, thanks to himself, she no longer felt, or from some capricious instinct which might at any moment revive in her, he would lean in impotent anguish, blinded and dizzy, over the bottomless abyss into which had passed, into which had been engulfed those years of his own, early in Marquemont's septennat, in which one spent the winter on the Promenade des Anglais, the summer beneath the limes of Baden, and would find in those years a sad but splendid profundity, such as a poet might have lent to them. And he would have devoted to the reconstruction of all the insignificant details that made up the daily round on the Côte d'Azur in those days, if it could have helped him to understand something that still baffled him in the smile or in the eyes of Odette, more enthusiasm than does the aesthete who ransacks the extant documents of 15th-century Florence so as to try to penetrate further into the soul of the Primavera, the fair Vanna, or the Venus of Botticelli. He would sit often without saying a word to her, only gazing at her and dreaming, and she would comment, "You do look sad." It was not very long since, from the idea that she was an excellent creature, comparable to the best women that he had known, he had passed to that of her being kept, and yet, already, by an inverse process, he had returned from the Odette de Crécy, perhaps too well known to the holiday-makers, to the ladies' men of Nice and Baden, to this face, the expression on which was so often gentle, to this nature so eminently human. He would ask himself, what does it mean, after all, to say that everyone at Nice knows who Odette de Crécy is? Reputations of that sort, even when they're true, are always based upon other people's ideas. He would reflect that this legend, even if it were authentic, was something external to Odette, was not inherent in her like a mischievous and ineradicable personality, that the creature who might have been led astray was a woman with frank eyes, a heart full of pity for the sufferings of others, a docile body which he had pressed tightly in his arms and explored with his fingers, a woman of whom he might one day come into absolute possession if he succeeded in making himself indispensable to her. There she was, often tired, her face left blank for the nonce by that eager, feverish preoccupation with the unknown things which made swans suffer. She would push back her hair with both hands. Her forehead, her whole face would seem to grow larger. Then suddenly some ordinary human thought, some worthy sentiment such as is to be found in all creatures when, in a moment of rest or meditation, they're free to express themselves, would flash out from her eyes like a ray of gold. And immediately the whole of her face would light up like a grey landscape swathed in clouds, which suddenly are swept away and the dull scene transfigured at the moment of the sun's setting. The life which occupied Odette at such times, even the future which she seemed to be dreamily regarding, Swann could have shared with her. No evil disturbance seemed to have left any effect on them. Rare as they became, those moments did not occur in vain. By the process of memory, Swann joined the fragments together, abolished the intervals between them, cast, as in molten gold, the image of an Odette compact of kindness and tranquillity, for whom he was to make later on, as we shall see in the second part of this story, sacrifices which the other Odette would never have won from him. But how rare those moments were, and how seldom he now saw her. Even in regard to their evening meetings, she would never tell him until the last minute whether she would be able to see him, for reckoning on his being always free, she wished first to be certain that no one else would offer to come to her. She would plead that she was obliged to wait for an answer which was of the very greatest importance, and if, even after she had made Swann come to her house, any of her friends asked her halfway through the evening to join them at some theatre or at supper afterwards, she would jump for joy and dress herself with all speed. As her toilet progressed, every movement that she made brought Swann nearer to the moment when he would have to part from her, when she would fly off with irresistible force. And when at length she was ready, and plunging into her mirror a last glance, strained and brightened by her anxiety to look well, smeared a little salve on her lips, fixed a stray lock of hair over her brow, and called for her cloak of sky-blue silk with golden tassels, Swann would be looking so wretched that she would be unable to restrain a gesture of impatience as she flung at him. "So that is how you thanked me for keeping you here till the last minute, and I thought I was being so nice to you. Well, I shall know better another time." Sometimes, at the risk of annoying her, he made up his mind that he would find out where she had gone, and even dreamt of a defensive alliance with Forcheville, who might perhaps have been able to tell him. But anyhow, when he knew with whom she was spending the evening, it was very seldom that he could not discover, among all his innumerable acquaintance, someone who knew, if only directly, the man with whom she had gone out, and could easily obtain this or that piece of information about him. And while he was writing to one of his friends, asking him to try to get a little light thrown upon some point or other, he would feel a sense of relief on ceasing to vex himself with questions to which there was no answer, and transferring to someone else the strain of interrogation. It is true that Swann was little the wiser for such information as he did receive. To know a thing does not enable us always to prevent its happening, but after all, the things that we know we do hold, if not in our hands, at any rate in our minds, where we can dispose of them as we choose, which gives us the illusion of a sort of power to control them. He was quite happy whenever Monsieur de Charlus was with Odette. He knew that between Monsieur de Charlus and her nothing untoward could ever happen, that when Monsieur de Charlus went anywhere with her, it was out of friendship for himself, and that he would make no difficulty about telling him everything that she had done. Sometimes she had declared so emphatically to Swan that it was impossible for him to see her on a particular evening. She seemed to be looking forward so keenly to some outing that Swan attached a very real importance to the fact that Monsieur de Charlus was free to accompany her. Next day, without daring to put many questions to Monsieur de Charlus, he would force him by appearing not quite to understand his first answers, to give him more, after each of which he would feel himself increasingly relieved, for he very soon learned that Odette had spent her evening in the most innocent of dissipations. "But what do you mean, my dear Mémé? I don't quite understand. You didn't go straight from her house to the Musée Grévin? Surely you went somewhere else first, no? That is very odd. You don't know how amusing you are, my dear Mémé. But what an odd idea of hers to go on to the Chat Noir afterwards. It was her idea, I suppose. No, yours? That's strange. After all, it wasn't a bad idea. She must have known dozens of people there. No, she never spoke to a soul. How extraordinary. Then you sat there like that, just you and she, all by yourselves. I can picture you sitting there. You are a worthy fellow, my dear Mémé. I'm exceedingly fond of you." Swan was now quite at ease. To him, who had so often happened when talking to friends who knew nothing of his love, friends to whom he hardly listened, to hear certain detached sentences, as, for instance, "I saw Madame de Crécy yesterday. She was with a man I didn't know." Sentences which dropped into his heart and passed at once into a solid state, grew hard as stalagmites, and seared and tore him as they lay there irremovable. How charming by way of contrast were the words, "She didn't know a soul, she never spoke to a soul." How freely they coursed through him, how fluid they were, how vaporous, how easy to breathe. And yet, a moment later, he was telling himself that Odette must find him very dull, if those were the pleasures that she preferred to his company. And their very insignificance, though it reassured him, pained him as if her enjoyment of them had been an act of treachery. Even when he could not discover where she had gone, it would have sufficed to alleviate the anguish that he then felt, for which Odette's presence, the charm of her company, was the sole specific, a specific which in the long run served, like many other remedies, to aggravate the disease, but at least brought temporary relief to his sufferings. It would have sufficed had Odette only permitted him to remain in her house while she was out, to wait there until that hour of her return, into whose stillness and peace would flow, to be mingled and lost there, all memory of those intervening hours which some sorcery, some cursed spell had made him imagine as somehow different from the rest. But she would not. He must return home. He forced himself on the way to form various plans, ceased to think of Odette. He even reached the stage while he undressed of turning over all sorts of happy ideas in his mind. It was with a light heart, buoyed with the anticipation of going to see some favourite work of art on the morrow, that he jumped into bed and turned out the light. But no sooner had he made himself ready to sleep, relaxing a self-control of which he was not even conscious, so habitual had it become, than an icy shudder convulsed his body, and he burst into sobs. He did not wish to know why, but dried his eyes, saying with a smile, "This is delightful. I'm becoming neurasthenic." After which he could not save himself from utter exhaustion at the thought that next day he must begin afresh his attempt to find out what Odette had been doing, must use all his influence to contrive to see her. This compulsion to an activity without respite, without variety, without result, was so cruel a scourge that one day, noticing a swelling over his stomach, he felt an actual joy in the idea that he had perhaps a tumour which would prove fatal, that he need not concern himself with anything further, that it was his malady which was going to govern his life, to make a plaything of him, until the not distant end. If, indeed, at this period, it often happened that, though without admitting it even to himself, he longed for death, it was in order to escape not so much from the keenness of his sufferings as from the monotony of his struggle. And yet he would have wished to live until the time came when he no longer loved her, when she would have no reason for lying to him, when at length he might learn from her whether on the day when he had gone to see her in the afternoon she had or had not been in the arms of Forcheville. Often, for several days on end, the suspicion that she was in love with someone else would distract his mind from the question of Forcheville, making it almost immaterial to him, like those new developments of a continuous state of ill health which seem for a little time to have delivered us from their predecessors. There were even days when he was not tormented by any suspicion. He fancied that he was cured. But next morning, when he awoke, he felt in the same place the same pain, a sensation which, the day before, he had, as it were, diluted in the torrent of different impressions. But it had not stirred from its place. Indeed, it was the sharpness of this pain that had awakened him. Since Odette never gave him any information as to those vastly important matters which took up so much of her time every day, albeit he had lived long enough in the world to know that such matters are never anything else than pleasures, he could not sustain for any length of time the effort to imagine them. His brain would become a void. Then he would pass a finger over his tired eyelids in the same way as he might have wiped his eyeglass, and would cease altogether to think. There emerged, however, from this unexplored tract certain occupations which reappeared from time to time, vaguely connected by Odette with some obligation towards distant relatives or old friends who, inasmuch as they were the only people whom she was in the habit of mentioning as preventing her from seeing him, seemed to Swann to compose the necessary, unalterable setting of her life. Because of the tone in which she referred from time to time to the day when I go with my friend to the Hippodrome, if, when he felt unwell and had thought, perhaps Odette would be kind and come to see me, he remembered suddenly that it was one of those very days. He would correct himself with an, oh no, it's not worthwhile asking her to come, I should have thought of it before, this is the day when she goes with her friend to the Hippodrome. We must confine ourselves to what is possible, no use wasting our time in proposing things that can't be accepted and are declined in advance. And this duty that was incumbent upon Odette of going to the Hippodrome, to which Swann thus gave way, seemed to him to be not merely ineluctable in itself, but the mark of necessity which stamped it seemed to make plausible and legitimate everything that was even remotely connected with it. If, when Odette in the street had acknowledged the salute of a passer-by, which had aroused Swann's jealousy, she replied to his questions by associating the stranger with any of the two or three paramount duties of which she had often spoken to him. If, for instance, she said, "That's a gentleman who was in my friend's box the other day, the one I go to the Hippodrome with." That explanation would set Swann's suspicions at rest. It was, after all, inevitable that this friend should have other guests than Odette in her box at the Hippodrome. But he had never sought to form or succeeded in forming any coherent impression of them. Oh, how he would have loved to know her, that friend who went to the Hippodrome! How he would have loved her to invite him there with Odette! How readily he would have sacrificed all his acquaintance for no matter what person who was in the habit of seeing Odette, were she but a manicurist or a girl out of a shop! He would have taken more trouble, incurred more expense for them than for queens. Would they not have supplied him, out of what was contained in their knowledge of the life of Odette, with the one potent anodyne for his pain? With what joy would he have hastened to spend his days with one or other of those humble folk with whom Odette kept up friendly relations, either with some ulterior motive or from genuine simplicity of nature? How willingly would he have fixed his abode for ever in the attics of some sordid but enviable house, where Odette went but never took him, and where, if he had lived with the little retired dressmaker whose lover he would readily have pretended to be, he would have been visited by Odette almost daily. In those regions that were almost slums, what a modest existence, abject if you please, but delightful, nourished by tranquillity and happiness, he would have consented to lead indefinitely. It sometimes happened again that when, after meeting Swann, she saw some man approaching whom he did not know, he could distinguish upon Odette's face that look of sorrow which she had worn on the day when he had come to her while Forcheville was there. But this was rare, for on the days when, in spite of all that she had to do, and of her dread of what people would think, she did actually manage to see Swann, the predominant quality in her attitude now was self-assurance, a striking contrast, perhaps an unconscious revenge for, perhaps a natural reaction from, the timorous emotion which, in the early days of their friendship, she had felt in his presence and even in his absence, when she began a letter to him with the words, "My dear, my hand trembles so that I can scarcely write." So at least she pretended, and a little of that emotion must have been sincere, or she would not have been anxious to enlarge and emphasize it. So Swann had been pleasing to her then. Our hands do not tremble except for ourselves or for those whom we love. When they have ceased to control our happiness, how peaceful, how easy, how bold we become in their presence. In speaking to him, in writing to him now, she no longer employed those words by which she had sought to give herself the illusion that he belonged to her, creating opportunities for saying "my" and "mine" when she referred to him. "You are all I have in the world. It is the perfume of our friendship. I shall keep it." Nor spoke to him of the future, of death itself, as of a single adventure which they would have to share. In those early days, whatever he might say to her, she would answer admiringly, "You know, you will never be like other people." She would gaze at his long, slightly bald head, of which people who know only of his successes used to think, "He's not regularly good-looking, if you like, but he is smart, that tuft, that eyeglass, that smile." And with more curiosity perhaps to know him as he really was than desire to become his mistress, she would sigh, "I do wish I could find out what there is in that head of yours." But now, whatever he might say, she would answer in a tone sometimes of irritation, sometimes indulgent, "Ah, so you never will be like other people." She would gaze at his head, which was hardly aged at all by his recent anxieties, though people now thought of it by the same mental process which enables one to discover the meaning of a piece of symphonic music of which one has read the programme, or the likeness in a child whose family one has known. He's not positively ugly, if you like, but he is really rather absurd. That eyeglass, that tuft, that smile. Realizing in their imagination, fed by suggestion, the invisible boundary which divides at a few months' interval the head of an ardent lover from a cuckold's, and would say, "Oh, I do wish I could change you, put some sense into that head of yours." Always ready to believe in the truth of what he hoped, if it was only Odette's way of behaving to him that left room for doubt, he would fling himself greedily upon her words. "You can, if you like," he would tell her. And he tried to explain to her that to comfort him, to control him, to make him work would be a noble task, to which numbers of other women ask for nothing better than to be allowed to devote themselves. Though it is only fair to add that in those other women's hands the noble task would have seemed to Swann nothing more than an indiscreet and intolerable usurpation of his freedom of action. "If she didn't love me, just a little," he told himself, "she would not wish to have me altered. To alter me, she will have to see me more often. And so he was able to trace in these faults which she found in him a proof at least of her interest, perhaps even of her love. And in fact, she gave him so little now of the last that he was obliged to regard as proofs of her interest in him the various things which every now and then she forbade him to do. One day she announced that she did not care for his coachman, who she thought was perhaps setting Swann against her, and anyhow did not show that promptness and deference to Swann's orders which she would have liked to see. She felt that he wanted to hear her say, "Don't have him again when you come to me," just as he might have wanted her to kiss him. So, being in a good temper, she said it, and he was deeply moved. That evening, when talking to Monsieur de Charlus, with whom he had the satisfaction of being able to speak of her openly, for the most trivial remarks that he uttered now, even to people who had never heard of her, had always some sort of reference to Odette, he said to him, "I believe all the same that she loves me. She is so nice to me now, and she certainly takes an interest in what I do." And if, when he was starting off for her house, getting into his carriage with a friend whom he was to drop somewhere on the way, his friend said, "Hello, that isn't Loredan on the box?" With what melancholy joy would Swann answer him, "Oh, good heavens, no. I can tell you I daren't take Loredan when I go to the Rue La Pérouse. Odette doesn't like me to have Loredan. She thinks he doesn't suit me. What on earth is one to do? Women, you know, women. My dear fellow, she would be furious. Oh, Lord, yes, I've only to take Rémy there. I should never hear the last of it." These new manners, indifferent, listless, irritable, which Odette now adopted with Swann, undoubtedly made him suffer. But he did not realize how much he suffered, since it had been with a regular progression day after day that Odette had chilled towards him. It was only by directly contrasting what she was today with what she had been at first that he could have measured the extent of the change that had taken place. Now this change was his deep, his secret wound, which pained him day and night. And whenever he felt that his thoughts were straying too near it, he would quickly turn them into another channel, for fear of being made to suffer too keenly. He might say to himself in a vague way, "There was a time when Odette loved me more," but he never formed any definite picture of that time. Just as he had in his study a cupboard at which he contrived never to look, which he turned aside to avoid passing whenever he entered or left the room, because in one of its drawers he had locked away the chrysanthemum which she had given him on one of those first evenings when he had taken her home in his carriage, and the letters in which she said, "Why did you not forget your heart also? I should never have let you have that back." And, "At whatever hour of the day or night you may need me, just send a word and dispose of me as you please." So there was a place in his heart to which he would never allow his thoughts to trespass too near, forcing them, if need be, to evade it by a long course of reasoning so that they should not have to pass within reach of it, the place in which lingered his memories of happy days. But his so meticulous prudence was defeated one evening when he had gone out to a party. It was at the Marquise de Saint-Huvert's, on the last for that season of the evenings on which she invited people to listen to the musicians who would serve later on for her charity concerts. Swann, who had intended to go to each of the previous evenings in turn, but had never been able to make up his mind, received while he was dressing for this party a visit from the Baron de Charlus, who came with an offer to go with him to the Marquise's, if his company could be of any use in helping Swann not to feel quite so bored when he got there, to be a little less unhappy. But Swann had thanked him with, "You can't conceive how glad I should be of your company. But the greatest pleasure that you can give me will be if you will go instead to see Odette. You know what a splendid influence you have over her. I don't suppose she'll be going anywhere this evening unless she goes to see her old dressmaker, and I'm sure she would be delighted if you went with her there. In any case, you'll find her at home before then. Try to keep her amused, and also to give her a little sound advice. If you could arrange something for tomorrow which would please her, something that we could all three do together, try to put out a feeler, too, for the summer, see if there's anything she wants to do, a cruise that we might all three take, anything you can think of. I don't count upon seeing her tonight myself. Still, if she would like me to come, or if you find a loophole, you've only to send me a line at Madame de Saint-Hubert's up till midnight. After that I shall be here. Ever so many thanks for all you're doing for me. You know what I feel about you. His friend promised to go and do as Swann wished as soon as he had deposited him at the door of the Saint-Hubert house, where he arrived soothed by the thought that Monsieur de Charlus would be spending the evening in the Rue La Pérouse, but in a state of melancholy indifference to everything that did not involve Odette, and in particular to the details of fashionable life, a state which invested them with the charm that is to be found in anything which, being no longer an object of our desire, appears to us in its own guise. On alighting from his carriage, in the foreground of that fictitious summary of their domestic existence which hostesses are pleased to offer to their guests on ceremonial occasions, and in which they show a great regard for accuracy of costume and setting, Swann was amused to discover the heirs and successors of Balzac's tigers, now grooms, who normally followed their mistress when she walked abroad, but now, hatted and booted, were posted out of doors, in front of the house on the gravel drive, or outside the stables, as gardeners might be drawn up for inspection at the ends of their several flower beds. The peculiar tendency which he had always had to look for analogies between living people and the portraits in galleries reasserted itself here, but in a more positive and more general form. It was society as a whole, now that he was detached from it, which presented itself to him in a series of pictures. In the cloakroom, into which in the old days, when he was still a man of fashion, he would have gone in his overcoat to emerge from it in evening dress, but without any impression of what had occurred there, his mind having been during the minute or two that he had spent in it either still at the party which he had just left or already at the party into which he was just about to be ushered, he now noticed for the first time, roused by the unexpected arrival of so belated a guest, the scattered pack of splendid, effortless animals, the enormous footmen who were drowsing here and there upon benches and chests, until, pointing their noble greyhound profiles, they towered upon their feet and gathered in a circle round about him. One of them, of a particularly ferocious aspect, and not unlike the headsman in certain Renaissance pictures which represent executions, tortures, and the like, advanced upon him with an implacable air to take his things. But the harshness of his steely glare was compensated by the softness of his cotton gloves, so effectively that, as he approached Swann, he seemed to be exhibiting at once an utter contempt for his person and the most tender regard for his hat. He took it with a care to which the precision of his movements imparted something that was almost over-fastidious, and with a delicacy that was rendered almost touching by the evidence of his splendid strength. Then he passed it to one of his satellites, a novice and timid, who was expressing the panic that overpowered him by casting furious glances in every direction, and displayed all the dumb agitation of a wild animal in the first hours of its captivity. A few feet away, a strapping great lad in livery stood musing, motionless, statuesque, useless, like that purely decorative warrior whom one sees in the most tumultuous of Mantegna's paintings, lost in dreams, leaning upon his shield, while all around him are fighting and bloodshed and death. Detached from the group of his companions who were thronging about Swann, he seemed as determined to remain unconcerned in the scene, which he followed vaguely with his cruel greenish eyes, as if it had been the massacre of the innocents or the martyrdom of St. James. He seemed precisely to have sprung from that vanished race, if indeed it ever existed save in the reredos of San Zeno and the frescoes of the Eremitani, where Swan had come in contact with it, and where it still dreams, fruit of the impregnation of a classical statue by some one of the master's Paduan models, or of Albert Dürer's Saxons. And the locks of his reddish hair, crinkled by nature, but glued to his head by brilliantine, were treated broadly as they are in that Greek sculpture which the Mantuan painter never ceased to study, and which, if in its creator's purpose it represents but man, manages at least to extract from man's simple outlines such a variety of richness, borrowed, as it were, from the whole of animated nature, that a head of hair, by the glossy undulation and beak-like points of its curls, or in the overlaying of the florid triple diadem of its brushed tresses, can suggest at once a bunch of seaweed, a brood of fledgling doves, a bed of hyacinths, and a serpent's writhing back. Others, again, no less colossal, were disposed upon the steps of a monumental staircase, which, by their decorative presence and marmorean immobility, was made worthy to be named, like that god-crowned ascent in the Palace of the Doges, the Staircase of the Giants, and on which Swan now set foot, saddened by the thought that Odette had never climbed it. Ah, with what joy would he, on the other hand, have raced up the dark, evil-smelling breakneck flights to the little dressmaker's, in whose attic he would so gladly have paid the price of a weekly stage box at the opera for the right to spend the evening there when Odette came, and other days too for the privilege of talking about her, of living among people whom she was in the habit of seeing when he was not there, and who, on that account, seemed to keep secret among themselves some part of the life of his mistress, more real, more inaccessible and more mysterious than anything that he knew. Whereas, upon that pestilential, enviable staircase to the old dressmaker's, since there was no other, no service stair in the building, one saw in the evening outside every door an empty, unwashed milk can set out in readiness for the morning round upon the doormat. On the despicable, enormous staircase which Swan was at that moment climbing, on either side of him at different levels, before each anfractuosity made in its walls by the window of the porter's lodge or the entrance to a set of rooms, representing the departments of indoor service which they controlled, and doing homage for them to the guests, a gatekeeper, a major domo, a steward, worthy men who spent the rest of the week in semi-independence in their own domains, dined there by themselves like small shopkeepers, and might tomorrow lapse to the plebeian service of some successful doctor or industrial magnate, scrupulous in carrying out to the letter all the instructions that had been heaped upon them before they were allowed to don the brilliant livery which they wore only at long intervals and in which they did not feel altogether at their ease, stood each in the arcade of his doorway, their splendid pomp tempered by a democratic good fellowship, like saints in their niches, and a gigantic usher, dressed Swiss guard fashion like the beadle in a church, struck the pavement with his staff as each fresh arrival passed him. Coming to the top of the staircase, up which he had been followed by a servant, with a pallid countenance and a small pigtail clubbed at the back of his head, like one of Goya's sacristans or a Tibellian in an old play, Swan passed by an office in which the lackeys, seated like notaries before their massive registers, rose solemnly to their feet and inscribed his name. He next crossed a little hall, which, just as certain rooms are arranged by their owners to serve as the setting for a single work of art from which they take their name, and in their studied bareness contain nothing else besides, displayed to him as he entered it, like some priceless effigy by Benvenuto Cellini of an armed watchman, a young footman, his body slightly bent forward, rearing above his crimson gorget an even more crimson face, from which seemed to burst forth torrents of fire, timidity, and zeal, who, as he pierced the Aubusson tapestries that screened the door of the room in which the music was being given, with his impetuous, vigilant, desperate gaze, appeared with a soldierly impassibility or a supernatural faith, an allegory of alarums, incarnation of alertness, commemoration of a riot, to be looking out, angel or sentinel, from the tower of dungeon or cathedral for the approach of the enemy or for the hour of judgment. Swan had now only to enter the concert room, the doors of which were thrown open to him by an usher loaded with chains, who bowed low before him as though tendering to him the keys of a conquered city. But he thought of the house in which at that very moment he might have been, if Odette had but permitted, and the remembered glimpse of an empty milk can upon a doormat wrung his heart. He speedily recovered his sense of the general ugliness of the human male when, on the other side of the tapestry curtain, the spectacle of the servants gave place to that of the guests. But even this ugliness of faces, which of course were mostly familiar to him, seemed something new and uncanny now that their features, instead of being to him symbols of practical utility in the identification of this or that man, who until then had represented merely so many pleasures to be sought after, boredoms to be avoided, or courtesies to be acknowledged, were at rest, measurable by aesthetic coordinates alone, in the autonomy of their curves and angles. And in these men, in the thick of whom Swan now found himself packed, there was nothing, even to the monocle which many of them wore, and which previously would at the most have enabled Swan to say that so-and-so wore a monocle, which no longer restricted to the general connotation of a habit, the same in all of them, did not now strike him with a sense of individuality in each. Perhaps because he did not regard General de Froberville and the Marquis de Bréauté, who were talking together just inside the door, as anything more than two figures in a picture, whereas they were the old and useful friends who had put him up for the jockey club and had supported him in duels. The General's monocle, stuck like a shell splinter in his common, scarred, victorious, overbearing face, in the middle of a forehead which it left half-blinded, like the single-eyed flashing front of the Cyclops, appeared to Swan as a monstrous wound which it might have been glorious to receive, but which it was certainly not decent to expose, while that which Monsieur de Bréauté wore as a festive badge, with his pearl-grey gloves, his crush hat and white tie, substituting it for the familiar pair of glasses, as Swan himself did when he went out to places, bore, glued to its other side, like a specimen prepared on a slide for the microscope, an infinitesimal gaze that swarmed with friendly feeling and never ceased to twinkle at the loftiness of ceilings, the delightfulness of parties, the interestingness of programmes, and the excellence of refreshments.
"Hello! You here? Why, it's ages since I've seen you!"
the General greeted Swan, and noticing the look of strain in his face and concluding that it was perhaps a serious illness that had kept him away, went on,
"You're looking well, old man!"
While Monsieur de Bréauté turned with,
"My dear fellow, what on earth are you doing here?"
to a society novelist who had just fitted into the angle of eyebrow and cheek his own monocle. The sole instrument that he used in his psychological investigations and remorseless analyses of character, and who now replied with an air of mystery and importance, rolling the R, "I am observing." The Marquis de Forestel's monocle was minute and rimless, and by enforcing an incessant and painful contraction of the eye, over which it was encrusted like a superfluous cartilage, the presence of which there was inexplicable and its substance unimaginable, it gave to his face a melancholy refinement, and led women to suppose him capable of suffering terribly when in love. But that of Monsieur de Saint-Condé, girdled like Saturn with an enormous ring, was the centre of gravity of a face which composed itself afresh every moment in relation to the glass, while his thrusting red nose and swollen sarcastic lips endeavoured by their grimaces to rise to the level of the steady flame of wit that sparkled in the polished disc, and saw itself preferred to the most ravishing eyes in the world by the smart, depraved young women whom it set dreaming of artificial charms and a refinement of sensual bliss. And then behind him, Monsieur de Palancy, who, with his huge carp's head and goggling eyes, moved slowly up and down the stream of festive gatherings, unlocking his great mandibles at every moment, as though in search of his orientation, had the air of carrying about on his person only an accidental and perhaps purely symbolical fragment of the glass wall of his aquarium, a part intended to suggest the whole, which recalled to Swann, a fervent admirer of Giotto's vices and virtues at Padua, that injustice by whose side a leafy bough evokes the idea of the forests that enshroud his secret lair. Swann had gone forward into the room, under pressure from Madame de Saint-Evert, and in order to listen to an aria from Orfeo, which was being rendered on the flute, and had taken up a position in a corner from which, unfortunately, his horizon was bounded by two ladies of uncertain age, seated side by side, the Marquise de Cambremer and the Vicomtesse de Franqueteau, who, because they were cousins, used to spend their time at parties in wandering through the rooms, each clutching her bag and followed by her daughter, hunting for one another like people at a railway station, and could never be at rest until they had reserved, by marking them with their fans or handkerchiefs, two adjacent chairs. Madame de Cambremer, since she knew scarcely anyone, being all the more glad of a companion, while Madame de Franqueteau, who on the contrary was extremely popular, thought it effective and original to show all her fine friends that she preferred to their company that of an obscure country cousin with whom she had childish memories in common. Filled with ironical melancholy, Swann watched them as they listened to the pianoforte intermezzo, Liszt's St. Francis preaching to the birds, which came after the flute, and followed the virtuoso in his dizzy flight. Madame de Franqueteau anxiously, her eyes starting from her head, as though the keys over which his fingers skipped with such agility were a series of trapezes, from any one of which he might come crashing 100 feet to the ground, stealing now and then a glance of astonishment and unbelief at her companion, as who should say, "It isn't possible. I would never have believed that a human being could do all that." Madame de Cambremer, as a woman who had received a sound musical education, beating time with her head, transformed for the nonce into the pendulum of a metronome, the sweep and rapidity of whose movements from one shoulder to the other, performed with that look of wild abandonment in her eye which a sufferer shows who is no longer able to analyze his pain nor anxious to master it, and says merely, "I can't help it," so increased that at every moment her diamond earrings caught in the trimming of her bodice, and she was obliged to put straight the bunch of black grapes which she had in her hair, though without any interruption of her constantly accelerated motion. On the other side, and a little way in front of Madame de Franqueteau, was the Marquise de Galardon, absorbed in her favourite meditation, namely, upon her own kinship with the Guermantes family, from which she derived both publicly and in private a good deal of glory, not unmingled with shame, the most brilliant ornaments of that house remaining somewhat aloof from her, perhaps because she was just a tiresome old woman, or because she was a scandalous old woman, or because she came of an inferior branch of the family, or very possibly for no reason at all. When she found herself seated next to someone whom she did not know, as she was at this moment next to Madame de Franqueteau, she suffered acutely from the feeling that her own consciousness of her Guermantes connection could not be made externally manifest, invisible character, like those which in the mosaics in Byzantine churches, placed one beneath another, inscribe in a vertical column by the side of some sacred personage the words which he is supposed to be uttering. At this moment She was pondering the fact that she had never received an invitation or even call from her young cousin, the Princesse des Laumes, during the 6 years that had already elapsed since the latter's marriage. The thought filled her with anger and with pride, for by virtue of having told everyone who expressed surprise at never seeing her at Madame des Laumes that it was because of the risk of meeting the Princesse Mathilde there, a degradation which her own family, the truest and bluest of legitimists, would never have forgiven her, she had come gradually to believe that this actually was the reason for her not visiting her young cousin. She remembered, it is true, that she had several times inquired of Madame des Laumes how they might contrive to meet, but she remembered it only in a confused way, and besides did more than neutralize this slightly humiliating reminiscence by murmuring, "After all, it isn't for me to take the first step. I am at least 20 years older than she is." And fortified by these unspoken words, she flung her shoulders proudly back until they seemed to part company with her bust, while her head, which lay almost horizontally upon them, made one think of the stuck-on head of a pheasant which is brought to the table regally adorned with its feathers. Not that she in the least degree resembled a pheasant, having been endowed by nature with a short and squat and masculine figure, but successive mortifications had given her a backward tilt, such as one may observe in trees which have taken root on the very edge of a precipice and are forced to grow backwards to preserve their balance. Since she was obliged, in order to console herself for not being quite on a level with the rest of the Guermantes, to repeat to herself incessantly that it was owing to the uncompromising rigidity of her principles and pride that she saw so little of them, the constant iteration had gradually remoulded her body, and had given her a sort of bearing, which was accepted by the plebeian as a sign of breeding, and even kindled at times a momentary spark in the jaded eyes of old gentlemen in clubs. Had anyone subjected Madame de Galardon's conversation to that form of analysis which, by noting the relative frequency of its several terms, would furnish him with the key to a ciphered message, he would at once have remarked that no expression, not even the commonest forms of speech, occurred in it nearly so often as, "At my cousin's, the Guermantes, at my aunt Guermantes, Elzear de Guermantes' health, my cousin Guermantes' box." If anyone spoke to her of a distinguished personage, she would reply that although she was not personally acquainted with him, she had seen him hundreds of times at her aunt Guermantes'. But she would utter this reply in so icy a tone, with such a hollow sound, that it was at once quite clear that if she did not know the celebrity personally, that was because of all the obstinate, ineradicable principles against which her arching shoulders were stretched back to rest, as on one of those ladders on which gymnastic instructors make us extend so as to develop the expansion of our chests. At this moment, the Princesse des Laumes, who had not been expected to appear at Madame de Saint-Ouvert's that evening, did, in fact, arrive. To show that she did not wish any special attention in a house to which she had come by an act of condescension to be paid to her superior rank, she had entered the room with her arms pressed close to her sides, even when there was no crowd to be squeezed through, no one attempting to get past her, staying purposely at the back with the air of being in her proper place, like a king who stands in the waiting procession at the doors of a theatre where the management have not been warned of his coming, and strictly limiting her field of vision so as not to seem to be advertising her presence and claiming the consideration that was her due to the study of a pattern in the carpet or of her own skirt, she stood there on the spot which had struck her as the most modest, and from which, as she very well knew, a cry of rapture from Madame de Saint-Ouvert would extricate her as soon as her presence there was noticed, next to Madame de Combremer, whom, however, she did not know. She observed the dumb show by which her neighbour was expressing her passion for music, but she refrained from copying it. This was not to say that, for once that she had consented to spend a few minutes in Madame de Saint-Hubert's house, the Princess des Laumes would not have wished, so that the act of politeness to her hostess which she had performed by coming might, so to speak, count double, to show herself as friendly and obliging as possible. But she had a natural horror of what she called exaggerating, and always made a point of letting people see that she simply must not indulge in any display of emotion that was not in keeping with the tone of the circle in which she moved, although such displays never failed to make an impression upon her, by virtue of that spirit of imitation akin to timidity which is developed in the most self-confident persons by contact with an unfamiliar environment, even though it be inferior to their own. She began to ask herself whether these gesticulations might not perhaps be a necessary concomitant of the piece of music that was being played, a piece which, it might be, was in a different category from all the music that she had ever heard before, and whether to abstain from them was not a sign of her own inability to understand the music and of discourtesy towards the lady of the house, with the result that, in order to express by a compromise both of her contradictory inclinations in turn, at one moment she would merely straighten her shoulder straps or feel in her golden hair for the little balls of coral or of pink enamel frosted with tiny diamonds which formed its simple but effective ornament, studying with a cold interest her impassioned neighbour, while at another she would beat time for a few bars with her fan, but so as not to forfeit her independence, she would beat a different time from the pianists. When he had finished the Liszt intermezzo and had begun a prelude by Chopin, Madame de Cambremer turned to Madame de Franquetot with a tender smile, full of intimate reminiscence as well as satisfaction, that of a competent judge, with the performance. She had been taught in her girlhood to fondle and cherish those long-necked, sinuous creatures, the phrases of Chopin, so free, so flexible, so tactile, which begin by seeking their ultimate resting-place somewhere beyond and far wide of the direction in which they started, the point which one might have expected them to reach, phrases which divert themselves in those fantastic by-paths, only to return more deliberately, with a more premeditated reaction, with more precision, as on a crystal bowl which, if you strike it, will ring and throb until you cry aloud in anguish, to clutch at one's heart. Brought up in a provincial household with few friends or visitors, hardly ever invited to a ball, she had fuddled her mind in the solitude of her old manor house, oversetting the pace, now crawling slow, now passionate, whirling breathless, for all those imaginary waltzing couples, gathering them like flowers, leaving the ballroom for a moment to listen where the wind sighed among the pine trees on the shore of the lake, and seeing of a sudden advancing towards her, more different from anything one had ever dreamed of than earthly lovers are, a slender young man whose voice was resonant and strange and false in white gloves. But nowadays the old-fashioned beauty of this music seemed to have become a trifle stale. Having forfeited some years back the esteem of really musical people, it had lost its distinction and its charm, and even those whose taste was frankly bad had ceased to find in it more than a moderate pleasure to which they hardly liked to confess. Madame de Cambremer cast a furtive glance behind her. She knew that her young daughter-in-law, full of respect for her new and noble family, except in such matters as related to the intellect, upon which, having got as far as harmony and the Greek alphabet, she was specially enlightened, despised Chopin, and fell quite ill when she heard him played. But finding herself free from the scrutiny of this Wagnerian, who was sitting at some distance in a group of her own contemporaries, Madame de Cambremer let herself drift upon a stream of exquisite memories and sensations. The Princess des Laumes was touched also. Though without any natural gift for music, she had received some 15 years earlier the instruction which a music mistress of the Faubourg Saint-Germain, a woman of genius who had been towards the end of her life reduced to penury, had started at 70 to give to the daughters and granddaughters of her old pupils. This lady was now dead, but her method, an echo of her charming touch, came to life now and then in the fingers of her pupils, even of those who had been in other respects quite mediocre and given up music, and hardly ever opened a piano. And so Madame Delhomme could let her head sway to and fro, fully aware of the cause, with a perfect appreciation of the manner in which the pianist was rendering this prelude, since she knew it by heart. The closing notes of the phrase that he had begun sounded already on her lips, and she murmured, "How charming it is!" with a stress on the opening consonants of the adjective, a token of her refinement by which she felt her lips so romantically compressed, like the petals of a beautiful budding flower, that she instinctively brought her eyes into harmony, illuminating them for a moment with a vague and sentimental gaze. Meanwhile, Madame de Galardon had arrived at the point of saying to herself how annoying it was that she had so few opportunities of meeting the Princesse Delhomme, for she meant to teach her a lesson by not acknowledging her bow. She did not know that her cousin was in the room. A movement of Madame Brancateau's head disclosed the Princess. At once Madame de Galardon dashed towards her, upsetting all her neighbours. Although determined to preserve a distant and glacial manner which should remind everyone present that she had no desire to remain on friendly terms with a person in whose house one might find oneself any day cheek by jowl with the Princess Mathilde, and to whom it was not her duty to make advances since she was not of her generation, she felt bound to modify this air of dignity and reserve by some non-committal remark which would justify her overture and would force the princess to engage in conversation. And so, when she reached her cousin, Madame de Galardon, with a stern countenance and one hand thrust out, as though she were trying to force a card, began with, "How is your husband?" in the same anxious tone that she would have used if the prince had been seriously ill. The princess, breaking into a laugh which was one of her characteristics, and was intended at once to show the rest of an assembly that she was making fun of someone, and also to enhance her own beauty by concentrating her features around her animated lips and sparkling eyes, answered, "Why, he's never been better in his life," and she went on laughing. Madame de Galardon then drew herself up, and, chilling her expression still further, perhaps because she was still uneasy about the prince's health, said to her cousin, "Oriane." At once Madame Delhomme looked with amused astonishment towards an invisible third, whom she seemed to call to witness that she had never authorized Madame de Galardon to use her Christian name. "I should be so pleased if you would look in just for a minute tomorrow evening to hear a quintet with the clarinet by Mozart. I should like to have your opinion of it." She seemed not so much to be issuing an invitation as to be asking favour, and to want the princess's opinion of the Mozart quintet, just though it had been a dish invented by a new cook, whose talent it was most important that an epicure should come to judge. "But I know that quintet quite well. I can tell you now that I adore it." "You know, my husband isn't at all well. It's his liver. He would like so much to see you," Madame de Galardon resumed, making it now a corporal work of charity for the princess to appear at her party. The princess never liked to tell people that she would not go to their houses. Every day she would write to express her regret at having been kept away by the sudden arrival of her husband's mother, by an invitation from his brother, by the opera, by some excursion to the country, from some party to which she had never for a moment dreamt of going. In this way, she gave many people the satisfaction of feeling that she was on intimate terms with them, that she would gladly have come to their houses, and that she had been prevented from doing so only by some princely occurrence, which they were flattered to find competing with their own humble entertainment. And then, as she belonged to that witty Guermantes set, in which there survived something of the alert mentality, stripped of all commonplace phrases and conventional sentiments, which dated from Mérimée and found its final expression in the plays of Meillac and Halévy, she adapted its formula so as to suit even her social engagements, transposed it into the courtesy which was always struggling to be positive and precise, to approximate itself to the plain truth. She would never develop at any length to a hostess the expression of her anxiety to be present at her party. She found it more pleasant to disclose to her all the various little incidents on which it would depend whether it was or was not possible for her to come. "Listen, and I'll explain," she began to Madame de Galardon. "Tomorrow evening I must go to a friend of mine who has been pestering me to fix a day for ages. If she takes us to the theatre afterwards, then I can't possibly come to you, much as I should love to. But if we just stay in the house, I know there won't be anyone else there, so I can slip away. Tell me, have you seen your friend, Monsieur Swann?" "No, my precious Charles. I never knew he was here. Where is he? I must catch his eye." "It's a funny thing that he should come to old Saint-Huvert's," Madame de Galardon went on. "Oh, I know he's very clever," meaning by that very cunning. "But that makes no difference. Fancy a Jew here, and she the sister and sister-in-law of two archbishops." "I am ashamed to confess that I am not in the least shocked," said the Princesse de Lôme.
"I know he's a converted Jew and all that, and his parents and grandparents before him, but they do say that the converted ones are worse about their religion than the practising ones, that it's all just a pretence. Is that true, do you think?"
"I can throw no light at all on the matter." The pianist, who was down to play two pieces by Chopin, after finishing the prelude, had at once attacked a polonaise. But once Madame de Galardon had informed her cousin that Swann was in the room, Chopin himself might have risen from the grave and played all his works in turn without Madame de Lôme's paying him the slightest attention. She belonged to that one of the two divisions of the human race in which the untiring curiosity which the other half feels about the people whom it does not know is replaced by an unfailing interest in the people whom it does. As with many women of the Faubourg Saint-Germain, the presence in any room in which she might find herself of another member of her set, even although she had nothing in particular to say to him, would occupy her mind to the exclusion of every other consideration. From that moment, in the hope that Swann would catch sight of her, the princess could do nothing but, like a tame white mouse when a lump of sugar is put down before its nose and then taken away, turn her face, in which were crowded a thousand signs of intimate connivance, none of them with the least relevance to the sentiment underlying Chopin's music, in the direction where Swann was, and, if he moved, divert accordingly the course of her magnetic smile.
"Oriane, don't be angry with me," resumed Madame de Galardon, who could never restrain herself from sacrificing her highest social ambitions and the hope that she might one day emerge into a light that would dazzle the world, to the immediate and secret satisfaction of saying something disagreeable. "People do say about your Monsieur Swann that he's the sort of man one can't have in the house. Is that true?"
"Why, you, of all people, ought to know that it's true," replied the Princesse de Lôme, "for you must have asked him 100 times, and he's never been to your house once." And leaving her cousin mortified afresh, she broke out again into a laugh which scandalized everyone who was trying to listen to the music, but attracted the attention of Madame de Saint-Huvert, who had stayed, out of politeness, near the piano, and caught sight of the princess now for the first time. Madame de Saint-Huvert was all the more delighted to see Madame des Laumes, as she imagined her to be still at Guermantes, looking after her father-in-law who was ill.
"My dear princess, you here?"
"Yes, I tucked myself away in a corner, and I've been hearing such lovely things."
"What? You've been in the room quite a time?"
"Oh, yes, quite a long time, which seemed very short. It was only long because I couldn't see you." Madame de Saint-Huvert offered her own chair to the princess, who declined it with,
"Oh, please, no, why should you? It doesn't matter in the least where I sit."
And deliberately picking out, so as the better to display the simplicity of a really great lady, a low seat without a back.
"There now, that hassock, that's all I want. It will make me keep my back straight. Oh, good heavens, I'm making a noise again. They'll be telling you to have me chucked out."
Meanwhile, the pianist having doubled his speed, the emotion of the music lovers was reaching its climax. A servant was handing refreshments about on a salver and was making the spoons rattle. And as on every other party night, Madame de Saint-Huvert was making signs to him, which he never saw, to leave the room. A recent bride, who had been told that a young woman ought never to appear bored, was smiling vigorously, trying to catch her hostess's eye, so as to flash a token of her gratitude for the others having thought of her in connection with so delightful an entertainment. And yet, although she remained more calm than Madame de Franquetot, it was not without some uneasiness that she followed the flying fingers. What alarmed her being not the pianist's fate, but the piano's, on which a lighted candle, jumping at each fortissimo, threatened, if not to set its shade on fire, at least to spill wax upon the ebony. At last she could contain herself no longer, and running up the two steps of the platform on which the piano stood, flung herself on the candle to adjust its sconce. But scarcely had her hand come within reach of it when, on a final chord, the piece finished and the pianist rose to his feet. Nevertheless, the bold initiative shown by this young woman and the moment of blushing confusion between her and the pianist which resulted from it produced an impression that was favourable on the whole.
"Did you see what that girl did just now, princess?"
asked General de Froberville, who had come up to Madame des Laumes as her hostess left her for a moment.
"Odd, wasn't it? Is she one of the performers?"
"No, she's a little Madame de Cambremer," replied the princess carelessly, and then, with more animation, "I am only repeating what I heard just now myself. I haven't the faintest notion who said it. It was someone behind me who said that they were neighbours of Madame de Saint-Huvert's in the country. But I don't believe anyone knows them, really. They must be country cousins. By the way, I don't know whether you're particularly well up in the brilliant society which we see before us, because I've no idea who all these astonishing people can be. What do you suppose they do with themselves when they're not at Madame de Saint-Huvert's parties? She must have ordered them in with the musicians and the chairs and the food. Universal providers, you know. You must admit they're rather splendid, General. But can she really have the courage to hire the same supers every week? It isn't possible."